You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, December 11th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Stanley Aronowitz, professor at the City University of New York, on his latest book, The Death and Life of American Labor. Also on the program today, the blood-sucking vultures. It's, I guess, a mixed metaphor. Responsible for the U.S. torture program, take to the airwaves to rationalize, to chest thump. Certainly not to hang their heads in shame. Also on the program today, Cromnibus, still in the U.S. House and Senate. All sorts of goodies in there. You know, we were told it wouldn't make a difference when the Republicans took control of the Senate, and they haven't yet. It's just simply in the offing. And already we could see private pensions cut via ERISA, truck drivers having to drive longer hours, campaign finance, Dodd-Frank, Pell Grants, all scaled back, and the will of Washington, D.C. residents to decriminalize pot also rolled back. Deportations at their lowest ever under the Obama administration. Still not saying that much. And Republicans consider on the eve, more or less, of them taking over the Senate, whether or not the filibuster reform rules will stay in place. Doesn't really work for them in the same way it does for Democrats because they don't have a president who's making nominations. And in the I reluctantly give credit where credit is due category, Andrew Cuomo informs insurance companies that gender reassignment surgery is to be covered. Don't like having to say something nice about Andrew Cuomo, but good behavior should be rewarded, even if it is limited circumstances. All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Before we go to Stanley Aronowitz, now, we haven't had we've got a new company where we're getting ads. I've never seen Matt react to an ad that we're going to run like this one. Now, I know this sounds a little bit like this the Alex Jones, like, totally impromptu.
Totally impromptu.
But totally impromptu situation. Matt was looking at the ad that we were doing today. He's like, holy cow, I'm going to get this. And I think everybody – and Amber came in today and said the same thing. We are all going to get new socks after the show today. This program is sponsored by Bombas. It's Bombas. And they're, you know, they're socks. They're like, well, they're normal socks for me. I don't even know how to, you know, they're, I guess they're sort of athletic, but they're just like normal socks.
They're nice socks.
They're not tube socks. That's what I, you know, that's what I consider athletic socks. And if you go to bombas.com/majority, you can get either a free pair of socks, literally a free pair of socks, or 20% off your entire first order. Maybe, I don't know if it works after that. You can get it like after your, for your second order too. But at the very least, your first order, 20% off all the socks. And on top of that, Bombas and a lot of these companies that where you buy stuff online now like this are doing this. And it's good. They give a pair of socks for every pair that you buy. They donate them to folks who are homeless. Socks being obviously a big issue. And I have to say that for me, my adulthood, or when I decided to become an adult, which I think was like deep into my 30s, was predicated on two things. One was collared shirts. I'm always going to wear collared shirts for the most part. And, you know, like there are times I wear T-shirts, but mostly collared shirts. And the other one was I'm not buying those crappy socks that I buy at the street fairs all the time because within 3 or 4 months I've got a hole in them. And then Nikki gets mad at me that I'm wearing socks with holes in it. And then I feel, you feel awkward that you're wearing socks and your daughter is saying like, why your socks have hole in it. So I get good socks now. And so I'm psyched about this. Bombas.com/majority. Use the coupon code, well, they give you a coupon code when you get over there. You can get more information at majority.fm if you can't remember any of this. Bombas.com/majority. 20% off your entire order or just a pair of free socks. This is a no-lose situation for you. I think you're going to be happy. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, Stanley Aronowitz. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program the author of over 24 books, the professor at the City University of New York, and the author of his latest, The Death and Life of American Labor, Stanley Aronowitz. Thank you so much for joining us, Stanley.
My pleasure.
So I want to start, before we get to the death, and then perhaps what might be the life of American labor in this country. I want to get to just prior to that, starting in the, I guess, the 20s and the 30s, really, where labor was really gaining its strength. And I don't know if it was quite at its peak, but perhaps you can tell us. And why... What was the context and the reasons for labor's strength at that time?
Well, in the first place, it was about the Depression. And the 20s were pretty dismal for the unions as well as for workers generally. Wages were cut in many industries despite the good times that were advertised by the media, much of the media anyway. The Depression really hit workers much harder than it hit almost any other sector of the economy of the society. And many of them were on part-time. Many of them saw their standard of living go through the floor. Many of them became homeless. We had a raft of Hoovervilles. And then what happened in 1933, 4 years after the Depression, was at its lowest, or 3 years after, which is 1930 and 31, actually. the economy began to improve slightly, like now. That is to say, years of doldrums, and then suddenly there was a growth. And in that period, unions that had been more established than others, like the clothing workers, the garment workers, and the miners, conducted the first major strikes for almost more than a decade. And those strikes were successful. They were accompanied by organizing, not only in New York City or Chicago, where the centers of a lot of those industries were, but in Pennsylvania, where contract work was, and mining was, and West Virginia, where mining was prevalent. And in 1934 to 1937, there was an enormous upsurge of union organizing. In Minneapolis, there was a general strike. In San Francisco, there was a general strike, both led by transportation unions. And in Toledo, it was auto workers' strike that almost led to a general strike. And there was a national textile strike in 1934, the first major strike in the textile industry in many years. And then in 1936, the rubber workers organized in Akron by a sit-down strike, which we would call sit-ins today, and that was from the civil rights movement. And then in 1937, a very famous sit-in or sit-down strike, which was conducted in Flint, Michigan, by the fledgling auto workers union in General Motors. Following those strikes, the rubber industry signed a contract for its industry with the United Rubber Workers, and the auto workers got General Motors to sign for its entire chain. And by 1941, not only the CIO, these were the CIO unions, the Congress of Industrial Organizations, which was a breakaway from the AF&L, but also the AF&L unions began to gain tremendous ground, so that while in 1930 there were 1.5 million workers organized into unions, by 1941 the number had increased to 11 million, so that they gained 9.5 million members in a decade. And that was an enormous gain. And that was really, in many ways, the height of both the militancy and the gains of membership of the labor movement.
And so was it just simply that people had gone through this sort of, I guess, acute economic trauma, or what else was in the ether in terms of, I mean, did we have individuals who had come from countries, let's say, recent immigrants who had come from a place where there was a more of a culture of worker militancy? I'm curious, in some way I want to draw a parallel to today. What were the factors that were in the ether that allowed for this type of militancy? Or was it simply because the deprivation was greater?
I think the deprivation was the foundation on the one hand, but there were two other factors that cannot be ignored. The first one you did mention, which is that a large number of immigrant workers had entered the steel mills, had entered other industries like the textile industry, and they did have traditions that were quite different than the traditional American workers. The second group that was very, very important was there was a rise of radicalism. And you can't underestimate the significance of the communist and the socialist parties and their organized effort to help build the labor movement. And that growth of both of those political parties, who didn't like each other very much, but they both agreed that the workers had to join unions in order to be able to improve their conditions, was very important. For example, if you look at the Minneapolis Teamster strike, which I mentioned before, or you look at the San Francisco general strike, both of them were led by communists, not only members of the Communist Party, but by small C communist sects. And the textile strike, the national textile strike, was led by a union that had a socialist basis. The garment workers and the clothing workers supported the textile workers, and both of them were socialist unions. The miners were led by John R. Lewis, and he was a very conservative guy, but he saw the handwriting on the wall. But it wasn't because he was far-sighted alone. It was because he was being pressured from within by a rank-and-file movement that threatened his leadership and threatened to overturn his administration. So there was a lot of turmoil within the unions and turmoil within the factories and the mines that was, to a large extent, led by radicals. Some of them were immigrants. Many of them were immigrants, but some of them were not. They were simply ideologues.
And so when we move forward in time and we talk about the beginning of the collapse of labor, I mean, let's talk about that. I mean, before we get to obviously your 10-point manifesto for a new labor movement, let's talk about that notion of where the seeds were sort of planted for at least labor, or I guess the union movement's demise. Part of that was a function of, at the very least, their expulsion of that radical element.
That's right. Not the socialists, but the communists. The Cold War and the anti-communist crusade, which was the basis internally of the United States, not only to fight against Russia, but of the Cold War against the left, was the first condition for the weakening of the labor movement, because the left, despite its ideological problems, and I think both socialists and the communists had ideological problems, serious problems, they were the militants, they were the activists, they were the talented organizers, not the only ones, but some of the major ones. The second thing that was very important, and I argued this in the book, is that the labor movement allowed itself, not only under the influence of the Cold War, but under the influence of the New Deal, which generally speaking helped workers with Social Security and unemployment insurance and jobs, actually, to some extent. 4 million jobs under the New Deal had been created. The labor movement welcomed the rule of law as the basis of labor relations, and the rule of law, to a large extent, was about calming down industrial and labor relations to a much more legalistic and a much more quiet process of union organizing and of labor relations. Collective bargaining, for example, was a alternative to the strike, alternative to the uprising that I described just before. And both of those factors, the legalization of the labor movement on the one hand and the Cold War on the other hand, made the unions much more complacent, much more incorporated, I say, or integrated into the main political and economic system of the United States. The radicals were either expelled or they became themselves much more, I would say, mainstream, if not conservative, at the very least, they accepted capitalism and all of its benefits that they saw as helpful to workers, without question.
All right, I want to dig into both these just a little bit more. On the side of the expulsion of sort of the radicals, to what extent was this a project of? I mean, how much of this was a side benefit to sort of the establishment that had sort of just been roiled by how much gains, I mean, that the labor movement had made, and how much of it was just sort of a coincidental consequence of the concern of the Soviet Union?
Well, I think they're both very important. When we talk about the expulsions of, there were 11 unions that were expelled from the Congress of Industrial Organizations, from the CIO. Some of those unions, for example, the United Electrical Workers, had about 500,000 members. They were the third largest union in the CIO. Another one, the mine mill and smelter workers, which were the non-ferrous metals miners, that are not the coal miners, but the people who are copper miners and miners of other kinds of metals. They were an old union that originally went back to the Industrial Workers of the World, which was the most militant union of the 1900s, early 1900s, and they had much of that tradition. So they were a thorn in the side of the leadership of the CIO. So the CIO, not only the government, but the CIO themselves helped with the expulsion of those unions. In fact, they expelled them at a convention in 19. The electrical workers left because they saw the explosions on the horizon, and about 10 other unions were expelled at the 50 convention. So that was one important factor. The second important factor, obviously, was that the government was going to collaborate with the anti-communists within the CIO and the AFL to get rid of the left because of both connection to the Soviet Union and the government's perception that in the face of the permanent war economy that was developed after the Second World War, we have not really had a non-war economy since 1938, that the left was going to oppose, the communist left primarily, was going to oppose the increase of armaments. They were going to disrupt in some of the defense plants that they had contracts, and the government did not want that to happen, and they actually in many ways were panicking. Now, this was not a government of the right wing. This was the Truman administration, a Democratic Party administration identified with American liberalism. And the liberals themselves, the anti-communist liberals, famous historian Arthur Schlesinger Jr. and the Partisan Review, which was a major literary magazine, and people like that, they joined in the Cold War attack against the communist left. They were very interested in that, and they collaborated with the unions as well as the government in doing that. While they attacked Joseph McCarthy for his excesses, they still wanted to get rid of the left as far as they could.
And so the elimination of the element within the labor movement that was willing to operate and looking to operate outside of, you know, to exercise, I guess, just raw power in some respect, is coupled with this second element that you had mentioned earlier, which I think is just sort of – it's fascinating because it is – certainly, I think it is in some respects counterintuitive, right? We perceive the notion of laws that edify the power of unions and collective bargaining as being strengths, but you talk about them as inhibitions, and that slowly began to have that same impact of basically domesticating in some way, I guess, unions.
I think that's a very good term, Sam. I think it is domesticating. And although the unions and workers that they represented, remember at one point, 37% of the private sector labor force was in unions. That is 1953.
One out of every three workers. I mean, that's more than
that's
one out
correct.
Of every three.
Yeah, but a little bit better than one out of every three, yes. And at one point, the union, and that point was when unions saw collective bargaining and organizing by way of a secret ballot election rather than strikes, by being cooperative with the federal administration, both of the labor law as well as the Democratic Party, that this was in fact the road ahead. Now, I argue in this book, in Death and Life of American Labor, that the problem was that they didn't see that a lot of these benefits, a lot of these gains were being made because of American economic expansion on a global scale. The United States and the Soviet Union were really, in many ways, the only two superpowers that survived the Second World War, and the Soviet Union was really decimated both economically and physically, and they lost 20 million people, by the way. That's right. Not small potatoes. The United States really, in many ways, was the dominant power, and Wall Street, as well as the federal administration, was prepared to share some of that benefit with a segment of the working class that was basically in the factories, because the factories were really the engine of American economic growth at that period. What they didn't anticipate, that is, the unions did not anticipate, was that at some point the economy might go through might tank. Or close to tank. And at that point, the problem with the labor movement is it had given up its most important weapons, namely the strike, aggressive organizing, especially of the newly developed industries of precarious workers and of temporary and contingent workers. And I say in this book, which is a little surprising, I expect, for many people who think about unions as blue collar primarily, the growing army of engineers and technical employees and doctors and other professionals who were beginning to become much more important in the high-tech economy than factory workers had been in the 1920s and 30s. And they had to organize them in order to maintain the power of the unions.
Right.
And you had to organize people in the lowest ranks, which were the poor, really, the working poor, and that they could not be organized by these traditional methods of union elections, because we were talking, for example, about a Walmart, which employs 1.1 million workers, or fast food chains, which have hundreds and hundreds of small stores. You had to organize in a different way, which now they're beginning to see that they have to do, but that's pretty late.
Right. Well, I want to get to that, because that's and I think I want to get to that, to the potential, I guess, for a new labor movement. But it's fascinating, because in some ways it's as if at that point the labor unions sort of decided to put their hands in these golden shackles.
Right.
Without the anticipation that there could be a sunset provision on the gold, and it just sort of it turns to lead after a certain period of time, and that's basically where we've been, right? I mean, and to what extent was Taft-Hartley? I mean, did unions embrace Taft-Hartley? Did they just not fight against it enough? I mean, that to me seems like one of the biggest, I guess, sort of. I guess restrictions on what unions need to do to exercise their power.
That's right. Rhetorically, Taft-Hartley, the amendments were passed by a Republican Congress, the 80th Congress of 1947. These were amendments to the National Labor Relations Act, which restricted the power of unions to engage in secondary boycott, for example, which meant that they couldn't boycott goods that they were not directly involved in. In other words, there's a strike in a factory or a strike in a retail store, and unions were prohibited from undertaking boycotts of the retail store that dealt with the factory that was under union attack. That's one thing. Two is that the Taft-Hartley said that no communist could hold union office. Which that was unconstitutional, and finally was overturned by the Supreme Court, but years and years later.
Right.
And there were other restrictions. For example, if there was a strike that the President of the United States decided was against the national interest, he could declare an emergency, forestall the strike for 80 days, in which period the federal government would intervene and try to mediate a settlement. If they couldn't mediate the settlement, then they can go back on strike. But after 80 days, everything would be, hopefully, from the point of view of the government, cooled off. Now, the unions opposed all that, except the anti-communist stuff. There was a lot of differences within the union. But they did not oppose it actively throughout the period of the 1950s and 60s. And up until today, they really haven't taken an aggressive stand against the Taft-Hartley amendments. So that they actually said, okay, well, we don't like this, but in fact, we're not doing so bad. Let's cool it, and we won't create problems with respect to a fight against Taft-Hartley. There were certain unions, not only of the left, but certain unions within the mainstream that did not like the Taft-Hartley and tried to oppose it. But the mainstream of the labor movement was committed, it seems to me, to complacency.
And that,
they let Taft-Hartley go.
That dynamic seems to be the preeminent dynamic amongst unions now, where You know, we saw it as recently in the context of the reelection of Andrew Cuomo in this state, where the sort of transactional relationship between the union and Andrew Cuomo was such that they really couldn't effectively or wouldn't effectively agitate against him. And this seems to be the dynamic, like where and it's almost as if unions and we've had, you know, many people on to talk about this, that it's almost as if like unions are in a death spiral insofar as like the more that they clutch on to their existing gains, the more inevitably is going to be taken away. We're seeing it right now, actually, in this omnibus spending bill with the reduction of private pensions for, I think, Teamsters, because, you know, we've allowed all the reasons why these pensions have been underfunded. But essentially, the unions have even signed on to this notion of like, all right, well, we're willing to take a, you know, whatever it is, 15, 20%, 10% cut on retirees' pensions to maintain what we have. Everything seems to be from a defensive position.
And it's a slippery slope. Today it's 15%. Tomorrow there's going to be another 15%. And the next day there'll be another 15%. So that there really is a basic problem. You know that the private pension system that the unions negotiated after the war was to a large extent the result of the weakness of the Social Security. Its failure to expand, its failure to increase compensation. So they said, look, we don't need Social Security for that. Our members will have Social Security, but they'll take care of about 50% of their income. We have to negotiate private pension plans. So they negotiated private pension plans, which enabled, for example, auto workers to retire at $3,500 a month. That's
right.
Pretty good.
Right.
And, you know, and suddenly the auto industry began to collapse. And the problems became significant for the huge number of retirees in that particular industry, and they began to lose ground. Now, the answer, obviously, to that situation would have been a resolute fight for a European-style social security system, single-payer health care, pensions that were basically funded by the you know, by the payroll and by the federal government, that would give people maybe 75 to 80% of their wages of their last 5 years of employment. That's what you have in France. That's what you have in Germany. That's what you have in Belgium, and certainly in the Scandinavian countries. But not in the United States. We love privatization, but privatization has proven to be chimerical. It's proven to be a fantasy, and it's no longer viable. And so what the unions have faced now is an Affordable Care Act, which really doesn't, it has deductibles of $5,000, $6,000 for people if they got a cheap version of the plan, a pension plan that's collapsing before our eyes, and a federal government, which basically is very happy to collaborate with the employers to make sure that workers are subordinated. I mean, that's the result of the complacency of which I just spoke.
So let's talk about some examples that we see present day that are sort of fighting back against that. I mean, and as we go into – let's actually go more explicitly into some of those 10 points that you're talking about, because – you know, on this program, we've talked about and talked to some examples of like the social justice union movement that's coming out of perhaps the Chicago Teachers Union, and Barbara Maldoloni in Massachusetts is also expressing this type of thing. We see this within the context of teachers. We're seeing obviously strikes amongst fast food workers who are theoretically, or they're organized, but they're not in a union per se. We're also seeing the Immokalee farmer workers down in Florida sort of taking more direct action and in an interesting way.
But tomatoes.
Yes, exactly. The tomato workers down there, and they're targeting not the people that they're working directly for, but they're targeting the end, or the, I guess, the mid consumer of those tomatoes, the Burger Kings that are actually serving those tomatoes.
And that's right.
But let's talk about what in some ways, the union should be pressing for as opposed to a contract.
Okay, well, look, one of the things that they have to press for right now, given the way in which the pension systems are collapsing and many people don't have any job security whatsoever, and no contracts even to even give them some version of that. And some people really don't even have Social Security because they never work at a single place for more than 20 weeks. And you have to have 20 weeks to be able to get unemployment compensation, and you have to have a whole record to be able to apply for Social Security. And if you get it, a lot of it is inadequate. So they need a guaranteed income. And the basic guaranteed income proposal, which has been around for a long time, and which President Nixon in 1971 actually suggested at $1,600 per capita, and the movement of welfare workers posed, because it wasn't enough and they made a mistake. The guaranteed income is one thing. Secondly, with the fact that there are no jobs, I mean, no real jobs in America anymore. I mean, there are, of course, at the highest levels, but there are no good factory jobs. There are no the public employment, which provided a lot of jobs over time, now is beginning to contract. The private sector is providing very, very minimum wages and so on. We need a minimum wage of $15 an hour, which is still inadequate, because based on 30 years ago, it should be $20 an hour. But we could start with $15. Third, we.
Stanley.
Technology.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Shorter hours.
We could
start with.
Stanley, hold on. Stanley, you just dropped out for a moment. I want to get back to that. The idea of a shorter work week. You just dropped out for a moment. Restate that for us.
Yeah, we need shorter hours, a shorter work week of 30 hours and a shorter work day of 6 hours a day. That would create more jobs than all the infrastructure proposals that the Obama administration and many other people have adopted. Infrastructure is high tech. And making computers and software computers is very high-tech. It employs relatively few employees. The oil industry basically is beginning to lay off people. And the fact that we today, on the 12th of December, it's gone to $65 a barrel.
Right.
We need shorter hours so we can spread the jobs.
And we see this in Germany, right? This work sharing and basically – and there are some states in this country –
And France has a seven-hour day.
There are some states in this country, my understanding is that they will give an opportunity to an employer to basically make up the pay. Instead of issuing unemployment insurance for workers they may lay off – they may say, okay, cut back your workers to 30 hours as opposed to 40 hours, retain your employee numbers, and we will subsidize, as opposed to providing unemployment insurance, we will make up that difference in pay.
The we is the government.
Right.
Yeah. Well, that's another alternative. Yes, of course. I mean, work sharing was part of the apparel industry's agreements with the employers for many years. In fact, in the ladies' garment industry, nobody ever got laid off. Mm. They simply had work sharing. Now, they didn't have the subsidy of the federal government or the state government, but they did, in fact, make sure people had jobs. And in this country, when you don't BP, for example, in oil, which has got 84,000 workers, British Petroleum is about to lay off thousands of workers. And, you know, there's no guarantee. They have no guarantees. Some of them will, of course, get buyouts. That is the managers and the high tech people if they lay them off. But basically, there's no way in this country that people can make a living or stay alive, really, without some kind of shorter hour as well as some kind of subsidy. Now, you could either do that with mandating shorter hours at the federal level, but at this point, that looks unlikely. You might want to do it at a state level and at the local level. Yes, that's very, very important. Europe is, Germany has a work sharing agreement in many of its industries. France has a seven-hour day. It's under attack. but right. I don't think they're going to be successful in overturning it right away. And I think the time has come that the United States has to join the human race, and especially of the advanced industrial societies that do provide shorter hours and work sharing.
I want to ask you one more about one more aspect of what you're suggesting should be a goal of a new labor movement. The idea of rank and filers demanding the right to create minority unions. What does that mean?
Well, what it means is what is what finally the UAW in the case of Volkswagen in
Tennessee
seems to be embracing, and I may have taken some credit for that. I don't know.
And in fact, my understanding is that as of 2 days ago, an accounting firm certified that they now represent more than 45% of Volkswagen workers. So explain to us that dynamic is.
Well, what happens is that you, let's assume for the sake of argument that you have signed up in a plant of 1,500. You have signed up 700 workers, 650 to 700 workers who have agreed to union representation. And so then you go to the employer and you go to the National Labor Relations Board and you say, well, either give us a card check for the 650 people who have signed up or 700 people of the 1,500 in the plant, or let us have an election for only those 700 people. And what that means is that you then can sign an agreement, a recognition agreement, which would oblige the company to negotiate with the union for the 700 people or 650 people. Those who did not elect to join the union do not get represented. Which, you know, is obviously very, very controversial because the unions chose winner-take-all style, which meant that they went for the whole bargaining unit, otherwise they wouldn't have a union. But I think the time has come where minority unionism, which is mandated as an option under the National Labor Relations Act, but has been ignored for basically 75 years, that minority unions should come back.
And this
you would
is
only be represented if you join the union.
This is particularly
and
important.
You only have the benefits of union membership if you join.
And this is particularly important, Stanley. This is particularly important. Correct me if I'm wrong, because the Supreme Court has attacked the notion of agency fees, and so
that's right.
And so wherein a union is allowed to collect essentially fees for negotiating in that winner-take-all scenario, where as long as there's
that's in public employment.
And that's in public employment. Okay, so
not in private employment. There's no agency fee in private employment.
Okay, and so but this will address that notion of like, you know, we're not you don't have to become a member of the union, but you still get our benefits. Well, now you get to actually compare apples to apples. This is what
I would get
in the union. This is what I wouldn't get.
I'm not for agency fee. I'm a public employee. I teach at a state-run agency called the City University of New York. I'm not for agency fee. I'm for minority unions, if that's necessary, or for unionism for those people who elect to join. And the unions are very upset about this position because the public employees unions benefit in terms of income, that is, of dues from those who are members and those who are not members. But it gives them a sense of complacency. So when I'm asked, and I was on the executive council of my own union, which is the Professional Staff Congress at CUNY, which is an AF of American Federation of Teachers affiliate. How would we support ourselves? I said, well, the way we support ourselves is we start collecting dues by hand. We don't have checkoff. We don't have agency fee. We really have to become a union again. That would be a very different kind of an organization than a bureaucratic top-down organization that collects everything, money, especially automatically.
That's
and I know it's, you know, union leaders shudder when they have to think about this kind of a situation, but I think it would be in the benefit of the membership to have I may sound like a conservative, but I don't think it's conservative. I think it forces the union to be on the ground all the time.
It forces them to be far more responsive.
It
forces them to be far more responsive to the needs of the members.
And that's right.
And but now how do you reconcile that with this other notion that in many respects, and, you know, this is what we see out of, let's say, the teachers unions in particular, this other notion that unions should be advocating not just, and you talk about it when you're talking about, you know, a guaranteed income, and we're talking about single payer health care. They should not just be agitating and working for the limited benefit of their own workers or members, but rather working people in general and issues that are impact. How do you reconcile those two things? One, that without an agency fee, for instance, you would require the leadership would have to be that much more sensitive to its specific members versus being accountable in some way or working towards goals for like the broader community.
Well, I think that's a tension which I think will be very helpful and very healthy. It's a tension between a union movement that sees itself as the tribune for the working people, the working class as a whole, and on the other hand saying we're a union and we will actually represent those workers who choose to join the union for the purposes of recognition and collective bargaining. That's a very, very complicated kind of relationship, but I don't think it is necessarily incompatible with what unions are about. For example, when the unions only represented a third of the labor force in 1949, or less actually, they supported the Wagner-Murray-Dingell bill, which was a Senate and congressional bill for universal health care. That was going to emulate the British system. They had not a majority of working people joining the union, but they did have the interest of the majority of the working people in terms of health care. What happened after that, when they lost the 49 thing, because the American Medical Association basically shot it down, when they lost universal health care, or what we now call single payer, they started to negotiate health care through the contract. And that kind of step, which may have been feasible at the time because they thought they had no alternative, led, if even unwittingly led, to that kind of saying, well, we're only representing our own members on any issue at all. We don't worry about working people as a whole. So they lost the fight in 49 and stopped fighting for universal health care. That's what happened. Except Medicare in 1966, when their members started to retire, they were very much interested in making sure the members had health care. So they fought for Medicare. But they didn't fight for universal health care anymore because they had all these private pension plans and private Social Security and they private pension plans and private health care plans.
Right.
And they said, we're sitting pretty. And they weren't sitting pretty. It was a chimerical deal that they were making with the bosses as well as with the government.
So ultimately, when we in beginning to conclude here, when we look across the landscape of labor, where should we be taking our cues, and what do, you know? I mean, ultimately, this is obviously a function of at one point it has to come from those who would be members of unions as opposed to the leadership or any there has to be enough of a political force out there. And are we seeing that in the context of the fast food workers?
We're beginning to see that. Yeah. I don't think it's developed as much as the unions would like to advertise it as developed, but it is the beginning of something. Let me give you an example from New York City. There's an organization, which I mentioned in my book, called the Taxi Workers Alliance. It doesn't have a contract with the people who lease them cabs. They no longer really have employers to a large extent. They're lease people. So they lease the cabs, and they're under the Taxi and Limousine Commission's regulation. But the Taxi Workers Alliance has been acting without a contract and without union recognition for a decade now, and they have 15,000 members, and they actually strike and they actually negotiate with the Taxi and Limousine Commission on issues of rates and they're beginning to think about benefits actually as well. It is a model that may or may not be universal, but there's one version of that in San Diego now. Same organization. It's called the United Taxi Workers, UTW. And they have the same kind of organization. No contracts, necessary benefits yet, but they have just gotten recognition from the employers and the Taxi and Limousine Commission down there, Taxi Commission down there, that they can actually bargain and represent taxi workers on grievances and so on. So it's really where we should be looking now is more informal, more rank and file, non-government, elections and recognition and things like that, but seeing people organizing themselves. I also mentioned some other things that you didn't mention, but you might see workers' co-ops.
Right.
Which I mentioned in this book, not only mentioned in the book, but it's very important. The unions used to run housing projects, which they still have relationships to, but people need housing. They're being thrown out. Working people can no longer afford to live in New York City.
Yeah.
So what is the relationship between that and the labor movement? Somebody's got to build housing for them. De Blasio, the mayor, says he'll build 200,000 units or renovate 200,000 units, but his development policy hasn't shown any inclination to really make affordable housing truly affordable. So somebody's got to take responsibility for that. Maybe it should be done by workers themselves who built houses on sweat equity, and they get land and they get materials from the state and local government. I mean, you know, you're not giving the government a complete free ride, but the initiative has to take place increasingly from below, from the workers themselves.
Stanley Aronowitz, The Death and Life of American Labor Toward a New Workers' Movement. Thanks so much for your time today.
And thank you for the interview. I'll talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, folks. We're going to head into the fun half. We will get to that Cromnibus. We will talk more on that tomorrow. John Brennan is going to be speaking on the torture report today at 1:30. Here's a guess what he's going to say. He's going to lie, and he's going to claim that we did save lives. But the way they will phrase it, I mean, this is my guess, right? He's not going to come out and say, contrary to the report, we saved lives. He's going to come out and say, the people from the CIA are patriots. They have worked hard. They have saved American lives. Have we made mistakes? Yes. And he's probably going to say what Tenet basically said, right? To that, we didn't have to be subpoenaed. We didn't have to do any of this. He's not going to mention the fact that they were caught spying on the Senate staffers. He's not going to mention that he had a front row seat. He personally, John Brennan, a front row seat to this torture. This is John Brennan in full CIA mode. And frankly, that's the entire CIA is like that. You know, who is it? Was it... And I want to talk about this, this Mitchell and Jensen. I mean, this is just, it's crazy. It's so repugnant. And it's even worse to see them come out and try and justify it. But Jose Rodriguez, the guy who was the head of CIA's counterterrorism center at the time, with, I think, Brennan. Brennan was also on that beat. This is the guy who destroyed the torture tapes. But he is shocked to find out that there were things like people standing on broken bones. I had no idea. I am glad for this report because we've really found some things here. And now that I am comfortable in knowing whose names are going to be redacted and what parts are redacted, I'm going to really talk about how I am just shocked to know this stuff. I can't believe it. And as a government official, I would never, ever, ever lie to the public or to policymakers. So you can absolutely trust what I'm saying now. Not before. But now that it's all come out. Now I can be honest, and in all honesty, I had no idea any of this was taking place. Absolutely, I'm shocked. Really, I do. I mean, you know, it's unlikely, but it would be great if this at least encouraged, if we don't see it in this country, maybe a state AG, I don't know, could bring charges against these members of the CIA or people who are involved in this torture. Apparently, this James Mitchell was, my understanding, I think I've heard it reported now, is that he was actually there for some of the early torture sessions. This is one of the two doctors. We're going to talk more about this in the fun half. But apparently, early on, these two contractors, guys who were semi-retired at that time, who had run the Air Force, I guess it's called the SEER program, which is basically to train, in this case, Air Force personnel, how to deal with torture if they get caught behind enemy lines, if they become a prisoner, how to deal with being tortured by these oppressive dictatorial regimes, right? These bad, bad, bad regimes that have no humanity and would torture their prisoners. So their job was to teach people how to withstand that torture and maintain their sanity. So these guys basically, more or less, we don't know exactly how it happens, but I'm going by his own statements in this Vice interview, offered up their services on not how to teach people how to withstand torture, but how to teach people to torture so that the subject of the torture could not withstand it. Aside from the fact that you've got these sadists, and Mitchell, and I think this is important to understand here, he sort of wrapped up in this is the fact that he had a good friend who was killed by an Islamic extremist group right around this time. Or a year or two prior, I guess. And so here's a guy who I think, I mean, this is just a real, this is a psychological problem manifesting itself and imposing itself, frankly, on the country. Guy earned $81 million with his buddy out of a $180 million contract. All right, we'll talk more about it in the fun half. We're going to go to the better half. And, of course, tomorrow on the program, Cliff Schechter and Andy Kindler. Andy Kindler, I imagine, will make some torture jokes. That's just the way he does. All right, folks, I want to remind you.
I don't think so. I think Andy's he's going to be good tomorrow.
All right. I'm not saying that's bad.
Smart guy.
The number 646-257-3920. Folks, I want to remind you, this program, and I don't know if it's because of the time of the year or what it is, but we've had a decent number of people who've had to cancel at least their payments. We will never turn anyone away for people who want access to the entire show for financial reasons. And so I want to remind you, and I think most of you know this, but if you're in that type of situation, just email us at majorityreporters@gmail.com. We will work out something with you. But if you do have the financial resources to support the program, the work we do here every day, it's not the cost of a coffee. I don't even know what you can get for 35 cents anymore, honestly.
Nothing.
I don't know, piece of gum? Do they sell single gum pieces anywhere? You can't even get like one of those individual peppermint patty things for 35 cents anymore. Now it's like 50 cents. So for the cost of less than a peppermint patty, a small peppermint patty on a daily basis, you can ensure that we're able to do this program. Don't look at me like that. You eat so much junk food. I don't know. I'm surprised that's not the only thing you eat. The peppermint
patties. I've never had a peppermint patty.
Well, you're missing out. But for the rest of you, miss out and just support this program. You can become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com or just head over to majority.fm. Also, if you buy your crap from Amazon, the least you can do, the least you can do is to buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com.
Ooh, kickback.
That's right. Not the best company when it comes to labor practices, although most of them aren't so great these days. But if you're going to buy from them, at the very least, use our link. We get a kickback. You'll support programs that will criticize their labor practices. So that's majorityreportkickback.com. Also, justcoffee.coop. Great labor practices. It's a co-op-owned coffee roaster. They give fair trade wages to everybody along their supply chain. It's also great coffee. Justcoffee.coop. You can use the coupon code MAJORITY to get 10% off. Great Hanukkah gift. Maybe a little bit late for Hanukkah. Great Christmas gift. Eid gift. New Year's gift. All right, folks. 646-257-3920 is the number.
Could arrive by the eighth day of Hanukkah.
Possibly. That's right. There you go. Here's Matt.
Molotov, Sam.
Right,
Molotov.
I was going to say. Scott Walker and me. All right, we'll be back in a second.